as we're shifting what the healthcare system looks like, we're also realizing that there's a lot of infrastructure and foundational scaffolding that needs to shift too to kind of support this new system. I don't care if you call it food as medicine or food as medicine. To me, it's getting, like, it's integrating nutrition services into the healthcare system.
SNAP benefits, you can buy groceries, but you can't buy a rotisserie chicken. Sometimes you need a rotisserie chicken. Welcome back to the Marianne Flaxman Network Podcast, a podcast dedicated to reintroducing personal narratives into critical public health topics. On today's episode, my conversation with Kristin Sukees. Kristin has worked in the field of food as medicine policy, broadly defined, for about a decade, and she has a long and winding path that led her there. In this conversation, we talk about that long and winding path, and we also discuss some of the most influential projects that Kristin has been a part of. We also talk about the interesting and long history of food as medicine, including discussing the fact that food as medicine has been acknowledged and appreciated by many cultures going back thousands of years. Finally, Kristin and I talk about her hopes and dreams for the future of the food as medicine policy space. Please enjoy my conversation with Kristin Sukees. Kristin, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks.
I'm so excited to speak with you today. And I want to start way back in the way back and ask you, what did you think you wanted to be when you grew up?
The most classic of questions. I always feel like I'm in a large percentage here. I always wanted to be a doctor. That was like something I was fascinated by since the beginning. I do not know why. It's a bit of a hypochondriac growing up, nervous Nelly, kind of still am. So maybe that has a component too, but, nobody in my family was in the medical field, so it's kind of out of left field. But yeah, I wanted to be a doctor. There was a small moment where maybe I was going to be a meteorologist also. I was fascinated by the weather.
Well, that's interesting. Now, like, meteorologist in an academic context, or were you thinking like weather girl?
Probably not weather girl, but I was both like scared and fascinated by tornadoes, loved the movie Twister. And so maybe not meteorologist, but maybe just like a climatologist. I don't know if that, I don't know the terminology. I clearly didn't go that path, but I was like, yes, I'm going to maybe not be a storm chaser, but I'm going to like get into the fascination of weather, which still boggles me.
Yeah. Well, something I was talking about on a previous episode with someone who you know, Emily Callahan, is like when she was a kid, she thought maybe she wanted to be an author. And then winding path, following her interests. And now she has many published works, but they're like proceedings from the National Academy of Science. So she sort of is an author, but not in a way that a little kid could possibly have known was possible. And so similarly, it's like when we're little, we think, oh, I want to be a doctor. I want to help people. I want to improve health. I'm curious about health. And we don't know that there's something like public health scholar, public health policy developer. Like that's not one of the Richard Scarry Busy Town characters. So we can't possibly place ourselves there. And so, you know, even though you're not a doctor, there's like echoes of that theme in the work that you're doing now. But like at age four, you're not like, I think I want to be like an epidemiologist or like a public health policy developer. Like there's just no way. So I think it's cool how the vibe stays, even though maybe the job title changes.
Yeah. I mean, exposure is just so important, right? Like growing up, like learning about all the different paths that we could take and what even work looks like. You know, it's constantly like, how do we expose kids to like every single possible option? And I know that's like no small feat, but it's really, really important. And of course, like the exposure like stretches beyond just like career paths and jobs and like relationship to work, but also, you know, religions and cultures and races and different ways of living at large. But I grew up with both parents who were lawyers. And so they, you know, dressed up in suits, not early 90s too, like dressed up in suits, went to the office. I had like one view of what work was. My mom was like a criminal defense lawyer working on federal issues. And my dad worked on environmental issues, a lot of like Superfund sites and toxic cleanups. And so more of like kind of a litigator there. So I grew up with this idea of like this awareness of like systems and how systems impact us individually and our health at large. And so I think that really had an impact on kind of like how I approached health later on. But it also had an impact on like how I viewed work. Like I thought that was kind of, you were this like kind of in this hyper professional realm. And during college, and I know we'll kind of get there a little later, but during college, I worked at a summer camp in Asheville, North Carolina. I led a mountain biking program down there. And I remember calling my dad, and I worked with people with all different professions. There were a lot of teachers, a lot of people with like non-traditional kind of like work paths. And that was my first exposure, like, you know, much later to people that were doing wildly different things. And even people like adults that had careers that were just in the outdoor world. I remember calling my dad one night sitting on a hill and just being like, "Dad, like, I don't have to work in an office. Like I could be a mountain bike instructor for the rest of my life. If I wanted to be, I could just be outside working with kids." And that idea kind of like blew my mind, even in my, you know, late teens, early 20s.
Yeah, and I totally relate to that. My childhood was spent watching my dad put on his suspenders to get ready for the 5:30 a.m. train to go into New York City. Like, that's what working looked like. And I had this weird split of having a stay-at-home mom and a hyper-professional dad, and I wanted to grow up to be both of them. And it's difficult to be both of those things at the same time. You can still see me struggling to make both of those things work. That's like my life story. But yeah, it's pretty much been a journey. And I think like as parents, so hearing you say that, what stuck with me is like, as parents, we don't know what theme our kid is going to take away from watching our experience. So in your case, you thought, oh, like there are these systems at play. Like my parents are both impacting these bigger systems that kind of trickle down and end up impacting individuals. Another kid might have just taken like the law is important or being a lawyer is cool, or there's so many different things that a person could take away. So I think like as a parent, but also as an adult in the world, modeling what it means to be an adult, which is a lot of figuring it out. I think most adults would admit that at this point. It's sort of important to realize that we're modeling for the younger generation and we don't necessarily know what we're modeling. So, you know, we should try to like do our best and then also maybe ask them like, so what are you getting from this, from seeing me do this? Like, what's your takeaway? Because I think if we don't ask what they're learning, we actually don't know.
Yeah. And I don't even think I could have articulated what I was learning, you know, growing up. I think this is in thinking about like, huh, how did I end up here? How did I end up with like systems work? I think only retrospectively I'm able to kind of connect the dots. And I think we can always connect dots, whatever dots we want to connect, we can find a way to do it. But yeah, like with my mom working in the criminal space as a defense lawyer, learning about how like the law is not written for people's benefit and, you know, people deserve second, third chances. And also like, is jail the correct like means of action? Probably not, definitely not. And so thinking about, you know, hey, this is something that these are structures that are created, but they're not serving us. And so how do we kind of fight against them, or how do we change them? You know, this kind of these discussions of like right or wrong and minimal sentences and stuff like that. So.
Yeah. And I kind of want to like put this out there, but maybe circle back to it, which is like this idea of justice and how. Again, like your parents were both sort of working in justice, and the work that you are now doing, have been doing, involves food justice, health justice. There's still this theme of, you know, what is just and what is right and how can we, you know, move closer towards that. And I think that that's so interesting because it's just another example of how many different ways there are to approach a problem, which makes me think of that quote, you know, like, don't ask what the world needs, ask what makes you come alive, because the world needs people that have come alive. Like, don't ask what the world needs, but ask which angle you can best approach that need from, because we need people who are giving it their all, whatever angle that might be.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Okay, so you went to college. You're a little kid. You want to be a doctor. You go to college. And what did little Miss, maybe a doctor, maybe a meteorologist, what did she go study?
You know, I took this justice lens, and I kind of became this, like, fierce, I don't want to say advocate, but I really adopted this, like, personal mission when I was in high school to get involved in, like, international peace movements. I don't know why, but I was really fascinated by that. And I, you know, I was just like, my mind was blown that, like, the world had so many atrocities and so much, like, pain and suffering and miscommunications between countries. And, you know, all of this is politics at play, but the people, the individuals are the ones that are impacted. And so I really dove deep into that and was driven to, like, kind of just focus on international stuff, even in high school. A friend and I started, like, a people-to-people international, like, kind of branch in our high school. And so we did a lot of, like, international, like, focused initiatives and hosted people from Egypt once who came for a peace conference. And so this idea of justice was then, like, yes, instilled in me. And then I was applying it kind of in the international space. I think also, like, growing up outside of DC, we were pretty, like, kind of DC centric family. I'm from Alexandria though. And I never felt really attached to the United States. I didn't feel attached to land or space or the country really. And I thought our country was doing a horrible job on stuff. I mean, not horrible, but, you know, not great. And so when I went into college, I both had this interest in international relations and also still medicine. I chose international relations, but I remember having a conversation my sophomore year. My mom was visiting. We went out to dinner and it was kind of like, okay, now's the time. Like, is it pre-med or is it, like, is it medicine or is it politics? And I chose international relations. Again, still kind of wanted to be this, like, you know, this, like, global citizen, like, person of the world and out there. I never really saw myself living in the United States even. I had this interest of just kind of being out abroad. And in that journey of international relations, I also kind of explored another topic in college, which was all around the connection between, like, science, technology, and people. And a lot of that work actually centered in the food systems too, in the food system. And so that was my first exposure to food systems and, like, looking at even, like, national politics on how our structures in the United States kind of impacted the food system, which impacted people's health, which impacted planetary health. And so suddenly I'm like, whoa, I love the land. Like, food system feels really, like, aligned with me. And it's this nexus between human and planetary health, which is really, really important to me. So I wrote this paper. I mean, you write a lot of papers in college, but I wrote this paper called The Cost of Slaughter. I was a vegetarian for many, many years. And yeah, like, that one paper, I feel like, kind of cracked my brain open to just how important and how impactful the food system is. So that planted the seed, but it wasn't for, like, years later until I actually kind of, like, circled back to the food systems work.
Wow. I just, like, love hearing the sort of tales of how thinking about one thing becomes another thing when you realize that those two things have way more in common than you possibly could have known from the outside. Like, yeah, if you look at a lot of international crises and war-torn areas, oftentimes food is a contributing factor or a major factor, or at least a factor that comes into play after the tragedy. You know, food is always at play. So it's so important to hear those stories and to think about how each one of us has this potential to discover a new problem to solve while following one path and then stumbling into another. So I do want to spend a fair amount of time talking about the path that you did stumble into, which is spending a lot of time kind of inaugurating, you know, starting, championing this food as medicine or food is medicine as it is now called policy space, but basically the development of policies that support the integration of food and nutrition access into healthcare administration and facilitation and healthcare policy in general. So what was your beginning moment? How did you first enter that scene?
Yeah, I'll say, you know, this movement was started like a long time ago. You know, some would say just, you know, thousands of years ago. Right. You know, the way that that Native communities and Indigenous communities relate to food, how emotional and how critical that is to culture and their society and health, and just like this awareness of like the power of food has existed for so long. And then the like medically tailored meals movement starting in the 80s as a response to HIV and AIDS wasting syndrome. And, you know, the original mission of those organizations was to like get people food. Like people are dying. They are not eating. They're not getting the calories, like get people food. And also like the medications, antiviral medications were most effective when people are nutritionally sound. So the first time that it was kind of like, oh, it's like medically appropriate to like have people, you know, eat nutritiously. It's like critical. It'll actually like save healthcare dollars because you're spending a lot of money on medication. And if it's not working, you know, I hate to kind of dehumanize it in that way, but like the system then was like, oh, this is important kind of financially as well. But I say all that because, you know, then that translated to the 90s and kind of this this broadening of the mission to beyond folks with HIV and AIDS, and looking at how important nutrition is to a variety of chronic conditions. And so there are people that have been working on this for, you know, since the 80s. I've been involved in those kind of like early organizations, which a lot of them were just nonprofits. You could also like, you know, talk about the Black Panthers and like a school lunch movement and all of that, right? That can be couched under this as well. But I got involved in this totally by chance. And I went to graduate school at Tufts, the Friedman School of Nutrition, Science, and Policy. And at Tufts, I studied agriculture. I came in with a mission of soil health. And then also like, you know, was able to kind of tinker in a bunch of public health spaces when I was in school. And when I left, I still then wasn't like aware of food as medicine, but I left with more of this kind of, I refocused my energy from like kind of soil health and had this interest in compost, closed loop systems to like, oh yeah, like I really want to work on kind of public health programs, public health nutrition, people-centered again. And there was this group. So, you know, it's such a winding path, right? Like I had a mapping project, a GIS mapping project as a final for my graduate school. And I reached out to the Greater Boston Food Bank because I'd worked with food banks in the past. And I said, hey, I have free labor, you know, what projects do you want to do? But you don't have the capacity to, like, I can do them for you. Hopefully they'd be helpful. And they didn't have the capacity to kind of manage, essentially like an intern on this. They were redoing their whole IT system. It just like was not a good time, but they were like, you know what? We know somebody else in the state, of Massachusetts that is working on a project that they want somebody to map something for. And they connected me to the folks at the Center for Health Law and Policy Innovation, which is part of Harvard Law School. And Chilpi, as it's affectionately known, Chilpi was writing, it was like just kind of wrapping up a 2-year data collection and starting analysis of this data collection, all to create the first state level food is medicine state plan. And That was my first exposure. I was connected to this team, totally random, and they needed a mapper. They needed somebody to map food insecurity, chronic disease, like where programs were across the state. And so I joined this team right when they were writing the Massachusetts Food as Medicine State Plan. And so I'll say, like, this team in particular too, you know, there's a huge history of people growing this movement, but this team also have been working on this for quite a while too. So I just joined them at that moment.
Yeah. And I love the historical context that you gave there. And I want to add, like, I do think that this modern iteration, which you and I talked offline about how sort of quickly the policy space in the last 5 years has pivoted and sort of adopted this term food as medicine, and you now hear it more and see it more. And even some pre-existing organizations who were doing this work are kind of changing their language and their narrative and now calling their work food as medicine work. Before, maybe they would have just said food access or community support, right? So it's like the narrative around it in this version is new. But of course, the work goes way back, as you said, thousands of years, you know, tens of thousands. And, you know, our great grandmas understood food as medicine. And I think that there's a great sort of feminist history of using food and herbs and compassionate care to heal people as opposed to just an industrialized Western system. So yeah, I just think it is very important to frame the modern conversation in the context of how much this has happened in various cultures throughout various generations. And we're just trying to, like, learn from that and bring it to the now and, you know, get insurance companies to pay for it. But I also think, again, it's so important that the way that you dove into this was coming from something totally different and just finding a place where your skills right here, right now, were the right fit to help support something that you also found was incredibly important to you. So you went and you were part of that incredible team. And I'm sure your parents raised an eyebrow, like, oh, you're working at a law school? Tell us more.
Yeah, actually, yeah.
They're like, are you thinking about staying? Oh, the apple wandering back towards the tree.
Yeah.
So then for the last, so how many years ago was that? What year did you join that center?
I started working with the Chilpi team like late spring, early summer 2018.
Okay. All right. So since then, you have been on this evolving food is medicine, food as medicine policy development, community support journey.
Yeah.
How has that been? Like, what have you seen? What have you felt?
Oh my gosh, it's been so inspiring. Like, so inspiring. It's really, you know, working in the policy space, it's kind of like a, you know, I feel like the terms are not quite adequate here, not quite right, but it almost feels like a luxury when you have the opportunity to, like, have movement in the space. There's a lot of initiatives and a lot of policy asks that maybe, you know, you're fighting for it and advocating for it for, you know, over a decade, you know, 2 decades, 3 decades, and you see minimal movement. And, you know, like, those are the people that I'm like, yes, keep going. Like, we need that. But I think it has been just so inspiring to see that change is possible. And that, you know, we've seen so much change, both at the state level and the like at the public, you know, public health, like state level, like Medicaid policy, the private sector, at the federal level, like congressional action, even the White House getting involved. Like, it is incredible to see the change that has happened even since, like, I first learned about food as medicine in 2018. I was just writing like a food as medicine primer and kind of listing out all of the recent initiatives, mostly at the federal level, national. And I was just, yeah, blown away. You have these big organizations like that I've always looked up to that have these food is like Feeding America, huge organization, Meals on Wheels, huge organization that have a food as medicine like initiative and arm and like are you know, part of this whole movement. And that's just really cool.
Yeah. I had the weird, gratifying experience of like a psychically producing a policy outcome. So when I was in grad school, I did for a final project, a food as medicine pilot program through the VA. And it was a graduate school project. So we didn't actually take it to Capitol Hill. We did like mock, you know, versions of it. And we had handouts and we had all the policy language and it was great. And I was like, ah, I really wish I, you know, could actually take this and advocate for it. Yeah. 1 month later, the VA announced a pilot program in food as medicine. And I was like, well, look at that, folks. We did it. We did it. Which, you know, I'm sure anyone who works in policy knows that you can work for a decade on one agenda and never see any movement. So to just transmit it psychically and still have it passed, I mean, what an experience. That was...
There's probably some other things I could feed into you to, like, you know, premeditate a little bit.
You know, I have a few crystals, so I'll just spend some time focusing on it and we'll get her done.
New strategy.
Call in the witches. I think food as medicine needs as many as we can get. So, of course, there have been a lot of wins and a lot of movement and a lot of traction. But because it is policy and because it is difficult and challenging work, and because, frankly, I don't think that the average person understands what happens in the policy sphere, I would love if you would share like a more challenging day, you know, at work in the salt mines of food as medicine. Like, was there ever a project that you were really psyched about that didn't get funded, or, you know, a moment where there was something that you hoped would pass like it was, but the language got watered down? Like, have you seen any roadblocks in the field while you're working on it?
I mean, yeah, of course. Of course there's roadblocks. I think, you know, the most classic of all, like capacity and money. You know, funding for public health at large is just drying up across our nation. And part of that involves, like, you know, even kind of Medicaid policy and Medicaid. The Medicaid system is like a separate set of kind of funding streams, but it's all integrated. And I think just, you know, state budgets right now are so low. States are in deficits. And, you know, everyone loves this concept of, okay, like, yeah, food is important. Nutrition is important. Yes, like the research is pretty strong. Like, you know, cost effective. And so, you know, sometimes cost savings with certain interventions as well. And so people are generally supportive, even if it's with like certain patient populations to be conservative with limited resources, people are supportive, but it's kind of the classic grind of like, we want to do this. We don't know where the money is going to come from. I think also, you know, maybe there's multiple policy pathways and policymakers kind of feel stumped on like, you know, which is the best policy pathway to go down. And then having that debate too, because it's great that there are a lot of options to get the Medicaid system to pay for food and support and reimburse food-based interventions. But there's a couple different ways to get there. And so there's kind of this gridlock of like, okay, well, great to have options, but how do we know which one is the best option for us? And so I think, you know, less around specific projects and more for general things. And then, you know, as we're shifting what the healthcare system looks like, we're also realizing that there's a lot of infrastructure and foundational kind of scaffolding that needs to shift too, to kind of support this new system. And so, you know, we need new medical codes to support the reimbursement of food as medicine system and the tracking and the evaluation of food as medicine programs. We also need, you know, much better and much more integrated technology systems to kind of create this community clinical system that we want. And this isn't just to support food, right? Like, this is to kind of reach outside the healthcare and hospital walls to be able to address the whole person and the whole person's needs. And that includes like, you know, health-related social needs and housing and transportation and, you know, my personal beliefs also like some kind of guaranteed income. So thinking about what what can actually boost whole health and how do we create a system that can, you know, allow that to happen, even if people are fully supportive.
Yeah, I remember one day in the task force meetings ahead of the White House conference when we were like developing the recommendations that we were going to submit in our report to the White House ahead of their conference, there was this conversation about food access and then, you know, what should policies pay for in terms of improving food access? And someone chimed in like, well, what if someone doesn't own any pots or pans?
Yeah, exactly. Cooking equipment, kitchen equipment.
Yeah. What if their stove doesn't work and they have, you know, a terrible landlord? What if they're living in a shelter? What if they're sleeping on a friend's couch? Like, you know, right now, SNAP benefits, you can buy groceries, but you can't buy a rotisserie chicken. Yeah. And we've all experienced the convenience of the rotisserie chicken, even if it's just once in a while in a blind panic because yeah. It's 8 p.m. and no one's eaten and the baby's crying. Like, sometimes you need a rotisserie chicken. So the fact that, I don't know, like in that moment, and I won't spend too much time on like my entry into this, but you and I kind of have opposite like paths in that then end up kind of mushing into a similar place. Yeah. I very much come at it from food, restaurants, cooking, me using food to heal myself. But there was that moment as I'm sitting there listening to this discussion where I'm like, not that I don't know that there are people dealing with that, but that I'm so glad there are other voices in this room because that would not have been top of mind to me. Like me waving a wand, getting a policy written about food access, I own too many pots and pans. Like I wouldn't have come to my mind to go like, well, what if someone doesn't have a skillet, you know? So yeah, there's so many, like if food is medicine, suddenly you can spiral into, well, certainly shelter would be medicine and definitely, you know, a calm nervous system that's not worried about bankruptcy tomorrow would be medicine. And there's a lot of medicine that we might implement in our culture. Food is just, it's so foundational. We all need it. We all do it. We all love it mostly, but it's not the only thing that could make a huge leap forward in our general well-being if we were willing to consider alternatives to pharmaceuticals that treat things in the late stages.
Right. I mean, that highlights the importance of collaborating with people with lived experience. And, you know, we think we're doing a good job up there in the eaves and like saying, oh yeah, we're going to like give people, you know, produce boxes. We're going to deliver them to their doorstep or something. And it's like, yeah, in theory, that sounds fantastic. Great. But you talk to people who are receiving these boxes and they're like, that's cool. Thanks for this butternut squash. It's just going to rot. Like I can't do anything with it. So like, thanks, but no thanks. So, you know, asking people and involving them in all of these processes, in the coalitions, in the policy discussions, in the program development, like what's actually going to be helpful for you? And, you know, that's where I generally circle back. And it's like, people need resources. People need money. You look at these studies and if people have more resources and are able to kind of choose where to spend it, they're going to spend it on things that make their lives better. You know, like they're going to be spending it on the transportation that they need to get their kids to school. They're going to be spending it on healthy food or food that has, you know, a variety of other benefits for their family. Like, these individual choices also are really important to well-being.
Yeah, I think feeling empowered is also medicine.
Yeah,
I
know. Empowerment. Exactly.
Yeah, yeah. Having autonomy and choice. Another thing that I really love about the food as medicine space is it's like a patchwork quilt of consultants doing a lot and different organizations doing many different types of work on this topic. And you are very well networked among this consultant and organization base. So I'm curious, like, you know, kind of pointing back to something that I say a lot is no skinny experts, by which I mean I prefer experts who have personal buy-in, who have lived it, and that's why they're experts in the space. Like, maybe they had a child with a chronic illness or a parent with a chronic illness, and that's why they care about health, whatever. Maybe they, like, were really passionate about soil, and that led them, right? Like, this personal buy-in that gets you to your expertise. For me, there are all kinds of ways to be an expert. I prefer that kind of expertise because it feels to me, I don't know, I don't want to be inflammatory, but like more trustworthy. Like if you have a personal buy-in to it, you're not going to abandon it because something shiny comes along. So I am very fascinated by all the different angles from which people approach this problem. And I'm curious to hear from you because you know so many different people working in food as medicine. Can you give us like a brief overview of like the many different ways that people come to this space? Like some come from ag, some come from medicine, some come from being a stay-at-home mom, being a lunch person, you know, like where's everyone coming from?
All over. You name a background, a stakeholder category, and people are getting involved. And we need that. We need these different perspectives to like go stronger together. I think just the stakeholder groups that are like immediately involved in food as medicine is quite broad. We have community health workers, we have program, managers, we have people like working on healthcare policy, we have physicians, we have nurses, like we have, you know, people leading coalitions and, you know, chronic condition specific coalitions and associations. And we have now like grocery stores getting heavily involved, like a lot of the private sector too, which I think is important for, you know, kind of broad success here. There's so many folks getting involved. And I think I can't speak to kind of why people get involved, but I think, you know, coalescing under one mission of feeling like it's right to be able to give people access to healthy food. To nourish themselves and their families, like that should be a given in our country. And so, it is important. It is part of healthcare, but like it's bigger than that. We need to give people access to healthy food. That is like a human right. And so I think everybody's coming to the table with that, that understanding and that angle and that mission.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. In the interest of time, I'm going to bring us to one final question, and we're going to end on a really big topic, which is food as medicine or food is medicine. These are two different ways, subtle but different, of speaking about the same topic. And the question is, does it matter? Do you have one that you side with versus the other? And should we all just pick one, or is it cool to go back and forth?
I have really strong feelings about this. And my feelings are that it doesn't matter at all. I feel like, you know, kind of wasting time and energy discussing it is distracting us. And I think like, you know, we can nitpick about language all day, and sometimes language is really, really important. And I'm not saying it's not, but we have bigger fish to fry. We got to get people food. We got to change Medicaid policy. I'm like, I don't care if you call it food as medicine or food as medicine. To me, it's getting like it's integrating nutrition services into the healthcare system. So, you know, I want a variety of nutrition services that can meet individual needs, and I want healthcare dollars to reimburse for it. And, you know, however we want to describe that, like health by food, food as medicine, you name it, that's fine, but I want the concept to be the same.
That's an excellent, excellent and hot take. And I like health by food, actually. I think maybe we should workshop more terms, you know, not just battle over these two, but throw a few more into the mix and start chopping it up and seeing which one feels the best. But for now, I think for my own off of my tongue, it just comes out food as medicine. So I'm going to use that, but I'm not going to go to war with anyone saying food is, because I agree. I agree with both. Okay, so looking ahead, what's your hope and dream for the next few years in food as medicine? Where do you hope we get in the next couple of years?
Wow. Well, I hope that California soon becomes the first state to actually include nutrition services as an official covered benefit. And I hope that also starts a cascade of other states. And while that's happening, I also hope that we have every state in the nation allowing at least their Medicaid, especially in the next couple of years, allowing Medicaid reimbursement for food as medicine services. Maybe through 1115 waivers, but I'm open to in lieu of services, I'm open to pilot programs, but let's get more people access to these critical interventions that are going to really help them and help their health.
Awesome. Well, Kristen, I really want to thank you for joining me today, and I really want to thank you for all the work that you've done and will continue to do. I know that food access and improving and expanding health policy is so important to you. And I love that you've brought this unique lived experience and winding path from soil health to agriculture to food to people to health, from wanting to be a doctor to helping people access care in a variety of ways. It's all connected, and it's really beautiful to see how one person's journey can lead them to do really meaningful work. So I truly appreciate you not just for joining me today, but for bringing yourself to this movement, because it's so valuable and it's so important.
Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. Thank you once again for listening to the Marian Flaxman Network podcast, a podcast dedicated to reintroducing personal narratives into critical public health topics. For more information on me, Marian, please visit my website at marianflaxman.com. For more information on my guest, Kristen Sukees, please find the links in the show notes. This episode was produced by Brain Trust Productions and sponsored by Informed Solutions Consulting. Thank you so much for listening, and we will see you next time.